In Romans chapter 13, the Apostle Paul says that Christians must be subject to earthly authorities, even ungodly authorities.
He's writing to the Romans. He's talking to people who are living under a secular government, a corrupt government, and indeed a government, incidentally, that executed the man who wrote these words.
Hello and welcome to Renewing Your Mind with R.C. Sproul. I'm Lee Webb. There is little question that we are living in tumultuous times in this country. Those who hold to a Christian worldview feel increasingly marginalized. It's tempting to read passages like Romans 13, where we're told to be subject to governing authorities and say, Paul wouldn't say that if he knew how bad things are now. Well, today, Dr. Sproul will help us see why the Apostles' words should give us pause, but also encouragement. This is from the series Christian Worldview, and it's designed to help us see the world through a biblical lens. I'll let you know how you can request all 12 lectures from the series at the end of the program today. But for now, let's join Dr. R.C. Sproul.
In this session, we're going to consider now the Christian as he relates to the governments of this world. And as you know, that also is a very controversial area of concern for the Christian, as some feel that the Christian belonging to another world, to the kingdom of God and to the kingdom of heaven, should have nothing whatsoever to do with the powers and principalities of this world. But I want to take the time today to look at chapter 13 of Paul's epistle to the Romans, which in its initial section at least gives us one of the most important pieces of instruction that we get in the New Testament with respect to our understanding of government. Chapter 13 begins with an exhortation and indeed an imperative from the apostle, in which he writes, "Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God." Let me just pause there for a second. There is no authority except from God. That is the ground basis and the foundation of all authority in the universe resides in the character of God. It does not reside in the will of man or in the will of human institutions, but ultimately authority derives from the author of all things, namely God Himself. And we must remember too at this point the statement that Jesus makes in the New Testament in terms of His relationship to the Father, by which Jesus said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given unto me." As part of the parenthesis, let me make this statement, which may sound extravagant, but I ask you to chew on it and think about it, and that is this, that Christianity as a life and worldview, as a living faith, is not merely a religion isolated from other dimensions of human life, and that's why we're dealing with these different concerns here, but that Christianity in its essential message is pervasively political. It is pervasively political. As I say, that may shock your ears off, but what I have in mind here is that the theme of the New Testament that we hear again and again and again is the announcement of the coming kingdom of God, the rule of God, the reign of God over this world. And in that sense, insofar as the New Testament is concerned with focusing on the kingship of Jesus Christ, the Bible is making a political statement. It is making a statement about authority and the regulation of life in this world. Not political in the human institutional sense. That's not what I mean. Though it touches human political matters, as we see here in chapter 13. There is no authority except from God, and those which exist, that is, those authorities which exist, are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordination or the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. So the text here is concerned about civil obedience, the Christian's responsibility to be subject to earthly spheres of authority. Seeing in those spheres of authority an authority that derives from God Himself. For again, Paul says, there is no government, there is no authority except that which is established, instituted, and ordained of God. That is one of the most difficult messages from the New Testament to hear, because it's particularly problematic that Paul makes these statements while he's addressing those who live where? In Jerusalem? You know, is he saying we all have to be subjected to the religious authorities of the Sanhedrin or to the theocratic authority of the state of Israel? He's writing to the Romans. He's talking to people who are living under a secular government, a corrupt government, and indeed a government that is opposed to the very principles of Christianity. And in a very short period of time after Paul wrote this letter, a government that set forth probably the most vicious program of persecution against the Christian church that has ever been unleashed in the history of the world. A government, incidentally, that executed the man who wrote these words, the Apostle Paul. He's saying, be subject to that government. And again, why? Not out of a view of political expediency, but out of a viewpoint of bringing honor and glory to God who stands behind that government. Now, how in the world could God be related to a godless government? How can God ordain an ungodly political institution? That's what has been so troublesome to people who wrestle with the responsibility that the church has with respect to matters of civil obedience. Because this passage, incidentally, is not an isolated one in the New Testament. Again and again, we are told to honor the king, to subject ourselves to the magistrates. And St. Peter tells us that we are to submit ourselves to the civil magistrates that Christ might be honored. Well, there are two things that we need to understand. In the first place, the concept biblically of all earthly government is, in a sense, hierarchical. That all human authority, from the dog catcher up to the governor and to the senator and to the prince or to the king or to the president, whatever, all comes under the authority of God and of His Christ. Now, does that mean that every one of these human authorities exercises godly rule? Of course not. We know that. And it is very possible for there to be, as Paul speaks of elsewhere, spiritual wickedness in high places, in governments. Oscar Kuhlmann, the Swiss theologian, even suggested that there's a sense in which governments in this world can become utterly demonic and stand in fierce opposition to the reign of Jesus Christ. Yet, the operative principle in the New Testament for the Christian is obeying the civil magistrate. Not because we are trying to exalt the human authorities, but we recognize that behind those authorities stands the authority of Christ and the authority of God. Okay? Again, Peter's statement, obey the civil magistrates that Christ may be glorified. How does my obedience of the political institutions and the civil magistrates bring honor to Jesus? There's a concept that I think is important for us to understand, and that is that in the New Testament, in fact in the Old Testament as well, that the idea of sin is not merely viewed in individualistic, bite-size pieces of particular sins or even of particular sinful people. But there is a concept of corporate solidarity where there are the sins of the nations. There is such a thing biblically as institutional sin. And so in our broad understanding of sin biblically, we see that sin is not merely particular, atomistic, and individual, but that there is what we call a complex of evil in the world. A complex of evil. And who stands behind the complex of evil? Theologically, Satan, the prince of this world. who is identified biblically with the Antichrist. The one who exalts himself above Christ and who moves and works contrary to, over against, the work of the Christ. Hence the title, anti. The word Greek there is anti, that just comes right over into English, and it can mean in place of or against, both of which we associate with the figure of the Antichrist biblically. He is one who not only stands against Christ, but who seeks to supplant Christ, who seeks to take the place of Christ. And the basic activity of the Antichrist, or of the cosmic struggle with Satan, is the induction to a spirit of disobedience, or what the Bible calls lawlessness. In fact, the Antichrist, in terms of his historical manifestation, is described by Paul in the Thessalonican correspondence as the man of lawlessness. So there's a certain sense that man's greatest problem, in other words, the thing that causes the whole creation in which we live to groan, is a spirit of lawlessness that is of the essence of sin. There would be no death in this world, there'd be no murder, there'd be no wars, there'd be no problems with the violation of human personality if, in fact, every person was lawful and obedient with respect to authority, namely the authority of God. So what we're seeing here is kind of a carryover, a spilling over of the spirit of man by which we begin with our refusal to obey God, and that spills over into our basic, natural, corrupt propensity to resist all other authority. So there's a sense biblically in which the Christian is called to bend over backwards to respect authority wherever he sees it, and to be bearing witness to a spirit of obedience rather than lawlessness. This came out very early in the Christian church with the outbreak of persecutions. We think, for example, of the work of the first great apologist of the early church, Justin Martyr. He wrote the first, what was called apologia, or reply, apologetic. Justin addressed his essay to the then Roman emperor, Antoninus Pius, and he was answering the charges that were brought against the Christians. Even Nero couldn't just send people to the lions or use Christians for human tortures without some kind of legal justification. Charges were brought against the Christians, and those charges included that they were atheists. Why? Because they did not believe in the gods of the Roman pantheon. No bowing to Jupiter and so on. They were accused of being cannibals. Why do you suppose that was? Because they gathered together to eat somebody's body and drink his blood. And so they had that problem. And then the third and biggest justification for the persecutions of the Romans was that the Christians were called to be seditious, insurrectionists, because they refused to recite publicly the loyalty oath of the empire, which in effect deified the emperor. And they were required to say simply, Kaiser Curios, Caesar is Lord. And they refused. They said, we say, Jesus ho Curios, Jesus is Lord. And therefore, because their refusal to submit to the absolute allegiance to the emperor that the emperor demanded, they were accused of being civilly disobedient and therefore thrown to the lions. Now, what Justin Martyr did when he wrote to the emperor was he tried to explain to the emperor of the Roman Empire what the Christian and biblical position was. He said, look at us. We are model citizens. Our religion teaches us to pray for the emperor, to honor the emperor, to be submissive. We're called to pay our taxes. We are called to honor you. We drive our chariots within the speed limit. But there is a limit to that. We cannot worship you. But when it comes to the daily practical matters of civil obedience, we are the model citizens of your empire. And the early church understood that accent in the New Testament. They were not given to anarchist activities or revolutionary activities. And Jesus had earlier rebuked the zealots that were seeking to overthrow the wicked governments by the power of the sword. Now, that has led some to the conviction and to the conclusion that therefore Christians must never disobey the civil authorities. But can we come to that conclusion biblically? Of course not. Because the Bible itself testifies when the authorities forbade Peter and John from preaching. You remember in the book of Acts, they said, we must obey God rather than men. So if the civil authority commands you, if this lower level of authority commands you to do something that God has forbidden, or forbids you from doing something God has commanded, not only may you disobey, but you must disobey. You must always obey God rather than men. But you're not called to disobey simply because you don't like the policies, or simply because they inconvenience you, or even may cause you to suffer. Because God has not commanded you to live a life free of suffering. But if the civil magistrate says you must do something like deny Christ, you have to disobey the civil magistrate. But again, do you see that the basic emphasis is the posture of bending over backwards, to be submissive in that spirit of humility when and wherever possible without compromising your commitment to God. Now, again, another reason for this is not only that God stands behind it, but that God ordains government in the first place. God ordains government in the first place. Where does government begin, earthly government or creaturely government? Where's the first illustration of it that we find in the Bible? Notice that there's an authority structure built into creation, but in that authority structure built into creation, there aren't any governments. Why not? What else was absent in the Garden of Eden? Evil, sin, all right? It's only after the fall of man that human government is established. And before that, a creature, I was using the word creaturely rather than human, because as soon as Adam and Eve are expelled from the Garden of Eden, and they are forced to live east of Eden, don't you think they would have a certain degree of homesickness? Don't you think that they would have liked to have returned? What would have happened if they wanted to return? Could they have gotten in? Why? Because there was an angel posted at the gateway to the Garden of Eden, and what did the angel have? A flaming sword. Why did he have a flaming sword? To keep them out, that is, to use the sword as an instrument of restraint, or as an instrument of power, or if you will, an instrument of force. Now, let me give you the simplest definition of government that we can come up with. Government, whether it is socialistic, communistic, whether it's oligarchy, plutocracy, you know, whatever it is, democracy, monarchy, any kind of government that exists is force. Government is force. And it exists under God as a force to restrain evil. For what purpose? Bottom line, for the survival of the race. For the protection, the sustaining, and the maintenance of human life and property. And God gives it authority and the power to back up that authority. That's why governments not only have law, but they also have law enforcement agencies. I talked to a United States senator a few years ago, and he made this statement to me over lunch. He said, I don't believe that any government ever has the right to coerce its citizens to do anything. And I said, that's a noble sentiment, Senator. But what I've just heard you say is that no government ever has the right to govern. If the governments don't have the right of coercion, what can they do but suggest? You have law without law enforcement. And I reminded him that the power of the sword that is established in the Old Testament and reiterated here in chapter 13, where if I can read for you quickly, verse 3, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it, that is the government, is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. It is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon one who practices evil. So what Paul is saying is that that power of the sword, God gives the civil magistrate. He does not give it to the church. Jesus takes the swords away from Peter and his friends in the Garden of Gethsemane. The church does not have the power of political coercion, but the state does. And its function and design and purpose of the sword is to protect the innocent and to restrain the evildoer. Now, does it ever happen that the government uses the sword to exploit and oppress the innocent and protect the wicked? Yes. And those governments are, of course, corrupt and demonic and should hear the prophetic criticism of the people of God. The idea that government, therefore, is evil casts a shadow upon the God who has established it and ordained it and instituted it in the first place. St. Augustine said this, governments are a necessary evil, not because every government is necessarily evil, but by the fact that government itself is made necessary by the fact of evil. And that even though governments may be oppressive and exploitive and corrupt, the worst government is still better than no government. Because the no government syndrome, which guarantees absolute freedom, also gives absolute freedom to the unrighteous people who can wield their power and corruption with no protection available to the innocent and the weak. Pure anarchy is the law of the jungle, which God says is not to be desired. So that God himself stands behind world governments, using them for his ends and for his glory, but principally as an instrument of the restraining power of evil. No matter how evil that government is, things can conceivably be worse. If God removed all human restraints, life would be intolerable upon us. And therefore, he has instituted government and given that government the sword to which we are called to give our righteous submission whenever possible. One final point. What if the Christian is called to serve in government? And that includes in the army or in the state house or whatever. If the government is doing the task that God has called it to do, I ask the question, why should not a Christian be expected to participate? That is to say, we cannot buy the idea that the church relates to God and that the state doesn't. Crucial point. Historically, in this country, we hold the idea of separation of church and state, but both church and state are under God. Church has its function, state has its function to perform. And so when the state is performing the function to which God has called it, we as people who are subjects of God should not be resisting it, but should be participating in it. But what has happened in our day is that the concept of separation of church and state has come to mean for many people the separation of state and God, as if the state ruled autonomously on the basis of its own intrinsic authority. Christians can't buy that. We see the state as answerable to God, ordained by God, and is certainly a legitimate vehicle for the people of God to serve God. That doesn't mean that we take the church into the state, but we take Christians because, you see, even though God is over church and state, the Christian lives in both church and state. And he has one set of responsibilities to the church and another set of responsibilities to the state, one of which is subjection to the powers that be.
Pretty clear, isn't it? We're glad you've joined us for Renewing Your Mind today. The series Christian Worldview is our focus this week as Dr. R.C. Sproul examines the worldviews at play in our society. Secularism, existentialism, humanism, pragmatism, and he does so over and against a Christian worldview. We'll be glad to send you all 12 lessons for your gift of any amount. Our number is 800-435-4343, or you can make your request and give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. Each of these lessons is 23 minutes in length, and if you teach a Sunday school class or a small group, or if you homeschool your children, this series will be helpful to you. Again, request Christian Worldview, and we'll send you all 12 lessons for your gift of any amount. You can call us at 800-435-4343, or you can make your request and give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. The aim of our program each day is to express the glory of God as revealed in the Bible. We want to equip growing Christians. To that end, there are many convenient ways to listen. You can visit renewingyourmind.org to listen daily or find an archive of past programs. If you prefer listening on the go, you can also find us in the Ligonier app, subscribe to the Renewing Your Mind podcast, or even receive a link to the daily broadcast by email every morning. If you have questions or need assistance, just call us at 800-435-4343 or visit renewingyourmind.org to view all of the options. Tomorrow, we'll wrap up Dr. Sproul's series on A Christian Worldview with a lesson on art.
The ultimate foundation and ground basis for aesthetics is the work of creation itself. God is the supreme artist.
We hope you'll join us Friday for Renewing Your Mind.